From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, The Myth of the Welfare Queen, we talk with journalist David Zucchino. His new book tries to answer the question, what do welfare mothers do all day? Also, screenwriter John Gregory Dunn talks about his 8-year odyssey working on the film Up Close and Personal. His memoir, Monster, explains how Hollywood execs turned the story of anchorwoman Jessica Savage's troubled life and early death into a feel-good romance. Ken Tucker reviews U2's new CD, and Jeff Nunberg considers the evolution of slang. Swell, cool, groovy, slammin'. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton has accepted Anthony Lake's withdrawal as his nominee for CIA director. Lake told the president he'd lost patience with the, quote, brutish and nasty confirmation process and expected, quote, endless delays. NPR's Martha Raddatz reports.
It wasn't that he didn't think he had the votes to be confirmed, nor was it because he was concerned about what he called further personal attacks. Lake withdrew his name, he told the president, because it, quote, is the right thing to do. In a 2.5-page letter, the nominee told President Clinton that Washington had gone haywire, that the confirmation process was a political football in a game with constantly moving goalposts. Lake said he had hoped there would be a vote on his nomination this week, but feared that there would be more questions with no end in sight. He likened the proceedings to a political circus. Of Lake's decision, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, Richard Shelby, said, "This nomination has been wrought with controversy from the beginning." I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
Desert towns in southeastern, rather southern California are counting the damage from a spate of earthquakes. No serious injuries are reported. In Barstow, a bridge over an interstate has a slight crack, but officials say the span is sound, so traffic is still moving over it. One witness at a drugstore says she has a mess on her hands after dozens of liquor bottles tumbled off shelves. The government reports more of the country is expected to be flooded this spring than in any other year in the past decade. The National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration says prospects for severe flooding are high in the upper Midwest, parts of the Southeast, and in the Mississippi, lower Missouri, and Ohio valleys. NOAA says there was a lot of snow in the region, and rather this past winter, leading to the increased chance of flooding in the spring. Builders have broken ground on a Jewish settlement in Arab East Jerusalem today. Israeli troops are on hand to keep Palestinian protesters away. Lori Neff is at the building site.
When word of the bulldozer's arrival reached the Palestinian protesters who are camped out at the edge of this disputed area in East Jerusalem, several dozen of the protesters started marching straight to the border or to the checkpoint. They were met by about 50 Israeli soldiers who held them back. And then I'd say about 100 other soldiers armed with automatic rifles and some gas canisters arrived on the scene and literally held the officials back.
Israeli officials plan to build 6,500 homes for Jews in the settlement, but the project could derail the Mideast peace process. Palestinians want to establish their future capital in East Jerusalem. Israel regards the whole city as its eternal capital. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 18 points at 6,937. Trading is active. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, at midday, stock prices are moving slightly lower on Wall Street. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Investors are apprehensive about rising interest rates. The argument for higher rates was bolstered this morning with news that starts on new housing during February unexpectedly jumped to the highest level in 3 years. The market is also uneasy about tomorrow's report on the Consumer Price Index, as well as what Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan might say during 2 days of congressional testimony on the financial markets and the economy, which begins tomorrow. The market's decline is being led by stocks most sensitive to changes in rates, like banks and electric utilities. I'm Doug Krisner.
Microsoft says it signed a deal with China's leading computer maker, Legend Group, to prevent theft of computer software. The agreement will allow Legend to install Windows 95 in its computers. A Microsoft official says the deal's the biggest agreement in China yet for the U.S. company. Piracy of computer software and other intellectual property has been a thorn in relations between Washington and Beijing. Consumer Reports magazine has released its best picks for vehicles. The magazine reports American automakers are catching up, but Japanese cars still outnumber recommended domestically made cars by nearly 2-1. The year's best family sedan is the Toyota Camry. The best small car is the Mazda Protege, and the Toyota 4Runner replaced the Ford Explorer as best sport utility vehicle. Coffee futures traders say there was a big drop in coffee prices yesterday. Coffee futures prices fell more than 17 cents per pound. Traders speculate that large coffee shipments to the United States will soon alleviate coffee shortages. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the New Prospect Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment and the Indiana-based Lilly Endowment Incorporated for coverage of religion.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Welfare Reform Act has done away with the guarantee of cash payments for low-income families with dependent children. My guest, David Zucchino, suspects that few of the senators and congressmen who voted for the bill had attempted to find out precisely what welfare recipients did with their government checks. In the months preceding the passage of the bill, Zucchino followed several unmarried welfare mothers living in North Philadelphia to find out more about their daily lives. His new book is called The Myth of the Welfare Queen. Earlier in the 90s, Zucchino covered that neighborhood for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's also been a foreign correspondent for the paper. He won a Pulitzer for his reporting from South Africa. He's now the Philadelphia Inquirer's foreign editor. I asked David Zucchino to describe the stereotype of the welfare queen.
The image of the welfare queen, I think, is someone who sits around all day watching soap operas, maybe sipping a little champagne and driving around in a Cadillac. It first came to public attention during the 76 campaign with Ronald Reagan, told a story that was proved to be apocryphal about a woman using many aliases to get benefits she wasn't entitled to, and she was definitely driving around in a Cadillac, at least according to the story that Ronald Reagan told, which was later proved to be not exactly true, exaggerated.
Now, did you start your book with the idea of dispelling the myth or investigating to see whether the myth actually correlated with reality?
I wanted just to see what the reality was. No, the idea was not to dispel the myth, but I had a pretty good idea after having covered North Philadelphia for 4 years. And this is an area that is heavily dependent on welfare, and I had a pretty good idea of how people manage their lives. And to some extent, the stereotype was true, but only for a small percentage of the population. The larger percent of the population was trying very hard just to struggle to get by.
A good deal of your book is devoted to the story of a woman named Odessa, who is a single mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother, and raising many of her grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Why did you choose her as the case study?
I had interviewed several people looking for someone who probably exemplified most closely what was happening in North Philadelphia, and the main reason I chose her is she had a real sense of responsibility and duty. And also, there was an intergenerational mix there. She was responsible not only for her children, but for her grandchildren and her great-grandchildren and an extended family. And I thought she personified a lot of what's happening in the inner cities in America, with women, particularly older women, being forced to take responsibility for the actions of their children and taking over the care of their grandchildren, which is a very common phenomenon in the inner city, as you know. And in her case, a number of people in her family, her daughters and granddaughters, had been abandoned by the fathers of their children and just left to fend for themselves, which really creates the whole problem of dependency. I mean, that's really where it starts. And she stepped in and took care of her her grandchildren, who had been abandoned by their mother, who was a heavy cocaine user and a prostitute.
I'm wondering if, just within Odessa's family, if you saw any generational differences between her attitude toward welfare and her life on welfare and those of her children.
Right. Her attitude that it was a blessing. She's a very religious woman, and she believed that it came from God, and that she had a responsibility to work hard, to be worthy of welfare. Her children were sort of mixed. Some felt it was their right to have help from the federal government. Others took it but did not feel good about it, felt a little guilty, were trying to get off, were not happy being on. Her grandchildren, one of them in particular, had a real sense of entitlement and did fit the stereotype of someone who sat around all day and ate potato chips and watched TV, which is what she spent a lot of her life doing. And as I detail in the book, there's a lot of tension between Odessa and her granddaughter. She was taking care of one of her granddaughter's children because she didn't trust her in the care of her granddaughter. So there was a real mix, and you could see by generation how attitudes had shifted.
So I don't know, outside of this family, you do have a lot of experience covering the neighborhood you're writing about. Would you feel comfortable generalizing about generational differences in welfare?
In generally, people in their 50s have a real sense of the work ethic, I think. And somehow, from that generation to the next generation of people in their 30s and 40s, that broke down. I would suspect it began in the 60s when the problem of unwed mothers really got serious in this country. With men abandoning their women, and that seemed to change the attitude. And I think a lot of people in that generation felt that it was not their fault entirely that they were in the situation. They tended to blame society and factors beyond their control. And the generation now, young women, say in their late teens and 20s, I think have become so accustomed to welfare and to that sense of federal entitlement, it is hard to break it.
You're looking at the daily life of a woman and her family living on welfare. How much money did Odessa get each week and each year from welfare?
From AFDC, she got $201 every 2 weeks, so that's $400 a month. She had $87 a month in food stamps. That's fairly low, but she also had SSI, Social Security program for disabled people, low-income people. She got $490 a month from that, and another $490 a month for her grandson, who was born cocaine addicted because of the cocaine used by his mother. So she came out to about $16,000 a year, which was far higher than typical welfare person in North Philadelphia, most of whom are in the $8,000 to $10,000 a year range. And for a family of five, the poverty line is $17,000. So Odessa was slightly under that.
So who was she supporting on the $16,000 a year?
A lot of people. Four of her eight grown children depended on her to some extent for loans and for a place to live. They were constantly coming in and out with their children and moving in and staying with her because of various calamities in their lives. She had her own four grandchildren. She had seven great-grandchildren. She helped her elderly mother, who's in her 80s, who lives in Philadelphia. So she was really the rock upon which this family, this extended family of some 60 people, was built. And then again, from time to time, she has a son who's working in New Jersey as a contractor, and she relied on him for help from time to time. But for the most part, there were a number of people who really depended on her.
One of the questions that drove your new book, The Myth of the Welfare Queen, is what does a woman on welfare do in a typical day? How does she spend her time? Give us a sense of how Odessa spent her time on a typical day.
Yeah, I was really stunned, not only with Odessa, but with other people I follow, just how much time every day these people spent just on subsistence concerns, just on finding food, finding a place to live, getting around. Odessa's typical day, she would get up about 6 during the school year. She would get her four grandchildren ready to go to school. She would take care of usually some great-grandchildren who were there that had to have their diapers changed and had to be fed. Then she would go out. If it was time to pick up her welfare check, that's a process that involves a couple of hours of waiting in line. She would be running various family members to the doctor. She was constantly going to the doctor with sick kids or taking her mother to the doctor, taking other members of her family to the doctor. In a typical day, someone from her family or the neighborhood would come to her seeking help with a problem, and she would get taken off on that. She spent an incredible amount of time foraging for food. looking for bargains at food stores and things on sale, trying to find clothes for her family. She spent quite a bit of time, what she called trash picking, was going to neighborhoods in the suburbs of Philadelphia and looking through people's trash, and she basically furnished her entire house with cast-off sofas and VCRs and refrigerators. She clothed all her kids and her extended family with clothes she found there. Her own clothes came from trash picking. And usually she didn't get through with what I call her job, which was her daily life, until 9 or 10 at night after she had cooked dinner for all her grandkids and for any other relatives who were staying with her. So she ends up putting in 16 hours a day.
Would you say that a lot of the people in Odessa's neighborhood were on welfare, too?
Oh, yeah. At least half.
Were there ways in which the neighborhood revolved around welfare and welfare checks in the mail?
Oh, yeah. You could see the days when people got their checks because they would be out making purchases, and they come every 2 weeks, and it's on a staggered system. There's not one day when everyone gets their check. But people, well, the first thing they did when they got their check was to repay loans that they had gotten from people of a few dollars. There's this constant system going of whether you know the day that your neighbor gets her welfare check, so you know when she's going to be flush, so you'll borrow money and pay it back when you get your check.
What else would happen on days when checks arrived?
People would make purchases. They would go to the corner store and buy their food for the next several days. In Odessa's case, she would set up a budget for the next 2 weeks and head out first and buy meat and enough frozen meat to last for a couple of weeks, depending on what store had the best sale. She would set aside some for her kids' snack money that she gave them to go to school every day. And then she would hand out little bits of money to various relatives who were in need, who knew what day she was going and who would suddenly appear.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Zucchino, and he's written a new book called The Myth of the Welfare Queen. And he's also the foreign editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. We'll take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with David Zucchino, for several years he covered the community of North Philadelphia and wrote a lot about drugs and welfare in that community. And now he's written a new book called The Myth of the Welfare Queen. One of the phenomena that you write about in your book is that on the day that food stamps come in the mail, there are guys who are known now as stamp men who come around and offer about, 70 cents on the dollar?
50 to 70 cents, right.
For food stamps. And so for people who need cash in a hurry, for instance, people who need cash to buy drugs in a hurry, they'll sell their food stamps for 50 to 70 cents on the dollar and get the cash that they need. What was the attitude in the neighborhood about the stamp men?
I think a lot of people were like Odessa, who really despised these people and felt that they gave people on welfare a very bad name. Other people obviously were more than happy to take advantage of it, even though they gave up half the value of the food stamps. I mean, they weren't interested in the food. These were people on drugs. Drug addiction is an incredibly serious problem. I mean, it's overwhelming in that neighborhood. And people, you know, there was a demand there, and the stamp men met it. They're very, very common. You'll see them outside welfare offices once a month when the food stamps come in, and you'll see people gladly, you know, giving up half the value just for a little bit of cash.
And what do the stamp men do with this? Do they then turn around and sell the stamps, or they use it to buy more food?
Yeah, or they can redeem them with a lot of merchants are willing just to take yet another cut of it and give them cash. And there were some drug gangs that'll even accept food stamps, you know, at, you know, 40 or 50 cents on the dollar as payment for drugs. And another thing the drug dealers will do is advance drugs in return for holding on to your welfare ID card until it's time for check day in 2 weeks, and then they accompany you down to the office and give you the card, and when you come out, they get their money back and you get your card back.
The neighborhood that you followed for The Myth of the Welfare Queen is a neighborhood you wrote about for several years for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and you did many stories in that period of time about the impact of drugs, specifically crack, on the neighborhood and, you know, on the young people of the neighborhood. What are some of the ways that the whole drug system affects daily life in the neighborhood?
Yeah, the illegal narcotics trade really has permeated all of North Philadelphia. You've got just thousands of kids who earn a living by selling drugs on commission, and when that money goes home, you know, it buys food, it buys sneakers, it buys clothes. A lot of people, and including middle-aged and elderly people, will let drug dealers hide the stashes in their homes. There's a really thriving underground economy of people who sell pipes, who sell syringes. There's prostitutes who feed off the drug trade, who offer sex in return for a certain amount of drugs. As I write in the book, there was hardly a family in North Philadelphia that I came in contact with that didn't have some connection directly or indirectly and who did not benefit from the drug trade. The DEA estimates that about $250 million a year in cash flows through North Philadelphia as a direct result of drugs.
It's an incredible paradox. The drugs that are tearing apart the neighborhood are also the only prospering economy in the neighborhood. So a lot of people who aren't drug dealers are actually making money off of it, because I guess it's just about the only economy there.
It's the only functioning economy, and welfare is the other source of income. It's not an economy, but it's the other. Those are the two main sources of income. And drugs are just everywhere, and a lot of people tolerate them because it's, first of all, it provides employment. It's a great source of employment for particularly young kids, and a lot of people get wealthy and pour their money into the neighborhood. A lot of the drug dealers will start up small businesses, mainly for the purpose of laundering money, but at least it provides some business. And obviously, the bodegas and these mom-and-pop grocery stores and beauty salons and video stores all rely on the income from drugs that people spend on these kind of services. So it really flows deeply into the society.
Based on the research that you did for your book, The Myth of the Welfare Queen, what would you say are some of the greatest misconceptions that a lot of people have about people on welfare?
Right. One is that they think that people on welfare have all this abundance of free time and all this leisure time, when in fact people are on the go constantly, I mean every moment, just trying to get food, trying to deal with the bureaucracy, which is very difficult. There are a lot of requirements under state welfare laws of documents that need to be provided, and you need to keep updating your status. Finding clothing, just doing the day-to-day things that come pretty easily for middle-class people who have a car, who have access to nice grocery stores and department stores and don't have to worry about you know, how much money they have that particular day. It's very, very time-consuming. I think another misconception that people have is that people want to be on welfare and enjoy being on welfare, and I found nobody who would admit to that. Obviously, there are some people who will take advantage of the system and don't mind being on welfare, but the vast majority of people I talked to would just love to have a job. The only thing they wanted was to have a job and have a little money and then not have to be dependent on this system. There's an example that I cite in the book. When a hotel was going up here in Philadelphia, they advertised for 500 and some jobs, and on the day that the jobs were available, 10,000 people showed up. I mean, that's a pretty good indication that people do want to work.
You wrote this book, you know, a case study in the welfare system just before the welfare reform bill was passed, which will completely change how welfare functions in the United States. So looking at the system right before the bill changing welfare, what would you say were some of the things that you thought obviously worked and obviously didn't work?
Right. The one thing that didn't work was this sense of lifetime availability of welfare, that the generation of young women do have that mentality, I think, not all of them, but some, that it was going to be there forever and that they could have babies and have them covered by the government, and made them less inclined, I think, to chase after their boyfriends and the fathers of their children for child support. That part of the system was not working very well. I think what really needs to be done under the new system, and it's not being provided for, is some sort of help with childcare, which is a huge problem for mothers who are trying to find a job and go to work. There's no one to leave, especially mothers of young children. There's no one to leave them with. Transportation is a huge problem. I think only about 10% or less of people on AFDC have access to have a car, or access to a car. If you're going to get a job, there are no jobs, almost no jobs in North Philadelphia. You have to go out to the suburbs. Where there are jobs, but even if you can get the fare for the subway and the train, it leaves you at a suburban station, and how do you get to your job from there? So I think these are the kind of problems that aren't dealt with really seriously under the new law, and I'm afraid a lot of these people are going to be set adrift, even if they have the strongest desire in the world to get a job and they go through job training programs. Just the practical necessities of life and housing. With some of the people in the book were homeless and going from house to house. There's really no provision above and beyond existing housing help, you know, to help people find a stable place to live before they can even think about getting a job.
How do you think the new welfare reform will affect the daily lives of the people who you followed?
Well, for the first 2 years, it might not make so much difference, but when that deadline starts coming and they will be cut off from their benefits and required to go to work, they'll have to take that two-year period and get ready to find child care, to find a place to live, to find transportation to work, to get into a job training program. It's going to completely turn their lives upside down, and I just don't think a lot of these people have the wherewithal to come up with that kind of help on their own. There's going to be increased reliance, I think, on friends and family members, particularly finding somebody to take care of your children during the day if they're preschool children, and even children in school, to have somebody at home to get the kids when they come back. I think what the law doesn't recognize is that the people that welfare is for are children, not the mothers. Of the, I think, 11.5 million people that were on AFDC as of earlier this year, 8 point some million were children. So we're not talking about a whole lot of adults, even though the debate in Washington during the welfare reform bill was completely on the mothers, whereas the children obviously are the ones who are going to be affected. And I just think it's wrong to hold the children responsible for the actions of their parents. And it puts an incredible amount of pressure on parents who want to do the right thing to get out and completely revamp their lives in 2 years.
David Zucchino, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
David Zucchino's new book is The Myth of the Welfare Queen. He's the foreign editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, turning the troubled life of Jessica Savage into a feel-good newsroom romance. Screenwriter John Gregory Dunn talks about his many frustrations during the 8 years he worked on the movie Up Close and Personal. Also, U2 goes pop, Ken Tucker has a review, and Jeff Nunberg considers the evolution of slang. We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. See you later, alligator, a slang expression usually associated with the 50s, actually goes back to the 1930s. Our language commentator, Jeff Nunberg, discovered that some slang expressions of today go back even further.
One of the most imposing books on my reference shelf is Volume 1 of Jonathan Leiter's Random House Historical Dictionary of American Slang. It appeared in 1994, taking 1,000 two-column pages just to cover the territory from A to G. It's a heroic work, all the more so because it rests on an impossible contradiction. It's true that all words depend on context for their meaning, but none so much as slang. And it's hard to know what to make of slang words when they're plucked from speech and laid out on the page in the haphazard order that the alphabet imposes. Gaga, galoot, gangster, gas jockey, geek. You think of a rack of old clothes in a thrift shop where a pair of bell-bottoms hangs between a raccoon coat and a Nehru jacket. You can find some of the context that's missing from Leiter's dictionary in an engaging recent book by Tom Dalzell called Flappers to Rappers. Dalzell has organized his book into a series of little essays on the language of each of the youth subcultures from the flappers to the hippies to the hip-hoppers. Take the jive generation of the late 30s and 40s. That was the golden age of greetings. Hello, Joe, what do you know? Hi, Sprout, what's growing? Hey, Sugar, are you rationed? And then there were all those rhyming salutations. What's buzzin', cousin? What's steamin', demon? What's knittin', kitten? It was also a lexicon rich in names for parts of the body. Your head was your biscuit, your fingers were fish hooks, feet were plates, your mouth was your bone box. And then there was the vast sartorial vocabulary of the zoot suiters. Hey, Jasper, put your barkers on your plates, pull up your pegs, tie your choker, and slap a sky piece on your biscuit. As you read through the book, your first sense is of how dated and quaint it all is. It's like leafing through a set of old college yearbooks. Did anybody ever really talk like that? Of course, it's in the nature of youth slang to be ephemeral. As in any other matter of style, you have to be ready to abandon it as soon as your parents catch on. That's how we knew sideburns were finished, was because we saw them on George McGovern. And by the 40s, the turnover in slang was even more rapid than before, with Madison Avenue and columnists like Walter Winchell publicizing each new expression as soon as it appeared. Dalzell dates the end of jive talk from 1946, when Hallmark came out with a new line of jive greeting cards called Solid Senders, which featured messages like, "What's tickin', chicken?" And yet, the idiom didn't disappear without leaving posterity with a few words that had surprising staying power, like groovy, chick, and hang-up. In the end, that's the most intriguing feature of flappers to rappers, all these words that keep being reused from one generation to the next. Dalzell gives a nice example in a little essay on the superlative bodacious. It began its life 150 years ago as one of the mock Latin coinings of the frontiersmen. In fact, one of the earliest citations is from Davy Crockett, who popularized the word in the 1840s. In the 1930s, it reappeared in Harlem Jive Talk, and then in the Barney Google comic strip. Lenny Bruce used it, and Marty Ballin of the Jefferson Airplane launched a short-lived band called Bodacious in 1973. From there, it moved into CB lingo, then into military slang and dude speak, as popularized in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. There are a surprising number of slang words like this. Dude itself has been used since the 1870s, as a synonym for guy or fellow. The use of fly to mean stylish goes back at least to the 1880s. And the hip-hop superlative fat is no less venerable. It was used as early as 1885, complete with that P-H-A-T spelling. In fact, maybe the most unusual item of hip-hop slang is the superlative fresh, which turns out to be a genuinely original addition to the idiom. What's interesting about all this isn't that the slang words have moved around so much, words always do that, but that they seem to keep covering their tracks as they go. Every generation rediscovers them as if for the first time and takes them as badges of its own unprecedented novelty. But that's how it is with generations. The costumes are always new, but they're cut from a familiar cloth.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center.
Yeah, baby, you want some sounds? I like them sounds. Well, I'm hip, I'm no square. I'm alert, I'm awake, I'm aware. I am always on the scene, making the rounds, digging the sounds. I read Playboy magazine, I'm so hip. Well, I'm big, I'm in step. When it was hip to be hep, I was hep. I don't blow, but I'm a fan. Oh, look at me swing, ring-a-ding-ding, yeah. I even call my girlfriend, man, I'm so hip. Now every Saturday night, with my suit button tight and my suede zone, I'm getting my kicks, digging those arty French flicks with my shades on. Woo, 'cause I'm too much, I'm a gas. I am anything but middle class. When I hang around the band, I'm popping my thumbs, digging the drums. Well, the squares don't seem to understand why I flip.
That's Bob Dureau. Coming up, a screenwriter explains why so many Hollywood films are so formulaic. This is Fresh Air. Why are so many Hollywood films contrived to be uplifting? And why do filmmakers compromise the complexity of their subject matter so that they can leave us feeling good? John Gregory Dunn's new memoir, Monster, is filled with explanations. It chronicles the 8 years that he and his wife, Joan Didion, wrote, rewrote, and revised the screenplay for the film Up Close and Personal. The film started as an adaptation of Golden Girl, a biography of the late network news correspondent and anchor Jessica Savage. When they were offered the project, they took it so that Dunn, who was having heart problems, could meet the Screen Actors Guild qualifications for health insurance. Dunn saw the Savage movie as the story of a small-town girl with more ambition than brains, an overactive libido, a taste for drugs, and a dependent relationship with an abusive Svengali figure, a story that ended with her death at the age of 35 in a freak accident. But by the time the film was finished, it was transformed into a feel-good newsroom romance starring Robert Redford and Michelle Pfeiffer. The transformation began at the first script meeting with Disney executives.
We went out to California, my wife and myself, and the two producers, and we met with Jeffrey Katzenberg and a whole contingent of Disney suits. And we had this meeting. There must have been maybe 10 or 11 people in this meeting, and everyone, of course, deferred to Jeffrey Katzenberg. And his first question was, does she have to die in the end? And we said, not if you don't call her Jessica Savage. And we thought that you could do a story of sort of an ugly duckling making good in the newsroom, which they liked. But they didn't want the more unseemly parts of Jessica Savage's life.
What were the first parts of your screenplay that changed after your meetings?
Well, we wrote a first draft screenplay in 1989, and we finished it sometime in the late spring or early summer of 1989. And this was a young woman with a lot of rough edges. Unlike Jessica Savage, who was sort of a middle class girl from Kennett Square, Pennsylvania, we made our character trailer trash from State Line, Nevada.
Let's stop right there. Why? Is that more saleable?
Oh, no. God, less. they were not interested in doing Jessica Savage. They were interested in doing a newsroom romance. They were not going to put in the unseemly parts of her life. So the idea was to try and keep some edge, but without the lesbianism, without the cocaine, without the abortions, multiple marriages, et cetera, and so forth. When we left that first meeting, we knew that Jessica Savage had ceased to be a factor in the Jessica Savage story, which automatically meant that we had to change her name. It meant that we could not put in this abusive relationship she had with a Svengali mentor who beat her up and fed her cocaine. So we had to take the newsroom and try and create a character. So we named her we named the character played by Michelle Pfeiffer, Sally Ann Atwater. And the only attribute of Jessica Savage that she had was that she had a lisp. We made her from sort of trailer trash from Stateline, Nevada, because it was a part of the country we knew, and we knew a lot about trailer camps because we'd written about them and the people who come out of them. The character who was ultimately played by Robert Redford, we named Warren Justice, and he was a kind of redneck from the South, sort of a redneck newsman.
You know, I'm wondering how important you think it is for the actors who carry the movie to be, beautiful. Michelle Pfeiffer, very beautiful. Robert Redford, very attractive. Do stars need to be, do you think, conventionally attractive to carry a movie? Or is there a certain kind of charisma that they can have that can carry it, even if they're not conventionally beautiful and handsome?
Well, very early on actually before Redford and Michelle Pfeiffer came on board, I asked the producer, Scott Rudin, I said, "Scott, what's this picture about?" And he said, "It's about two movie stars." And all of a sudden, it sort of clarified what we were doing. Essentially, we were making a 1940s Clark Gable, Joan Crawford movie. And once we understood that, it was easier to write. It was a 1940s movie, sort of a newsroom romance with two movie stars. And then you get Redford and Pfeiffer. I don't think movie stars have got to be beautiful. I don't think, for example, that Barbara Streisand is conventionally beautiful. Tommy Lee Jones is not conventionally beautiful. They bring personalities. It's not so much beauty as the personalities that they bring to the part.
In answer to a comment from a producer, you said, "I don't do love." What did you mean by that?
Well, we were doing one of the later drafts of the picture we were talking with Scott Rudin, and he came to our apartment, and Rudin never gives you notes. He sits there and he says, "Do this, do that, deliver the moment, more heat here, cut this, I hate this line, this is too OTN, which means on the nose, or this is OTT, over the top. And do this, do that, deliver the moment, more heat, more love. This is a love scene." And I said, "Rudin, I don't do love." And he said, "That's hilarious." What I meant was the kind of conventional sort of sticky love scene that you see in most movies. I think basically actors act that. That's what they get the big bucks for.
So you mean you don't have to write it in? The stars will just kind of put that in?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It's not in the dialogue. It's in
it's in the
passion of the embrace.
Yes,
when the two stars finally are united.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a certain amount of lead up to it, but I don't think that heat and passion are conveyed as much in words in the movies as they are by the two stars themselves or the two actors themselves.
Do me a favor, give us some numbers, the number of years you spent working on the screenplay, the number of rewrites you did, the amount of profit the movie actually made.
We worked on the picture off and on for 8 years. And I say off and on, this wasn't the only thing we did in those 8 years. We wrote half a dozen other scripts. We each wrote a novel. We wrote six other books between us. We did magazine articles, et cetera, and so forth. So we had a full plate during those 8 years. We did, before the picture started shooting, we did 27 drafts. That is from 1988 to 1994. We did 27 drafts. Actually 27 until March 1995 when the picture started shooting. Then during the course of the shooting, we worked every day with John Avnet. There was a 77-day shoot. He would call us from his house in California when he was leaving for work. He would call us in New York, ask us for the changes that he wanted in that day's script. when I say changes, I don't mean to sort of radical changes, but sometimes when actors are shooting a scene, they give a color to the scene that the script had not anticipated. And so you have to pick up that nuance in subsequent scenes. And so he would tell us what he wanted done that day and some problems that were coming along the line. I counted the other day that during the 77 days of shooting, we faxed John 489 times, 489 faxes, every one of those faxes containing script changes.
Was this movie worth it for you, looking back, if you had to do it over again?
Oh, sure. Sure. I mean, it's a job. I am a professional writer. You know, this is highly paid piecework.
Mm-hmm.
I come in with my eyes open. I know how the movie industry works. I'm not going to change it. I don't want to be a director. I do the job. I do the best possible job I can. I get paid, and I leave. What is nice is if the picture is made. Now, we've had 8 pictures made, and some of them are no good. Some of them were, at least 2 of them were very good. Several of them were profitable. I like doing it. I like the people. There are frustrations in doing movies, as there are frustrations in any job. The bottom line is, how professional are you? And I like to think that I'm extremely professional.
You say that you took on the project of writing Up Close and Personal, before it was called that, of course, because you needed health insurance. And you turned out to really need it. You ended up having open heart surgery, having a heart valve replaced while you were writing the movie. And I'm wondering if you thought a lot about what it would have been like if you hadn't gotten back on Screen Actors Guild health insurance.
I would have been broke. Because I not only had open heart surgery, as I was over the recuperative part of my heart surgery, I got blood poisoning from another source. I got bitten in the ankle by a bug. And I had a bacterial infection in my leg, which was probably could have been more dangerous than the heart surgery, because with the plastic valve, infection moves towards the foreign body. And so I was in the hospital for 9 days, sort of tied up to an industrial strength antibiotic, which was being leaked into my veins via an IV. And so the year that I essentially lost to medicine, if I'd had to pay for it, would have cost $150,000. I mean, that's a lot of money.
During one of your hospital stays, you were next door to Sonny Von Bülow, who at that point had been in a coma for about 10 years. And what could be more real than being next door to a woman who's been in that state for so long? But at the same time, Sonny Von Bülow was also, you know, the subject of a movie, another movie.
A very good movie, too.
Yeah, so I guess I'm wondering what that experience was like for you to think about being next door to her as a person and the subject of another screenplay.
I actually saw her. I actually got a fleeting glimpse of her one day. There was a guard outside her room. And the nurses would go in. And one day I was walking down the corridor, and there was a curtain just inside the door, and the nurse was going in and put the curtain aside, and I actually saw her asleep in her hospital bed. But I, you know, it actually did not occur to me that this was two different movies.
Well, you have a rewriting job that you're doing this week, and you have very little time to do it, so I'm going to let you get back to your work. And
okay,
first,
thank you very much.
I want to wish you a happy anniversary. We're recording this interview on the 6th anniversary of your heart surgery, in which you got a new heart valve, and I wish you a happy anniversary and good health.
Thank you very much. Here you go.
This is a big day of reflection for you?
No, I just have to go to work.
Okay, well, let me let you go. John Gregory Dunn, thank you very much. John Gregory Dunn's new memoir is called Monster, Living Off the Big Screen. Coming up, Pop, U2's new CD. This is Fresh Air. The Irish rock band U2 has a new album, its first in 4 years. It's called Pop, and much of it is influenced by the latest trends in techno and dance music. Rock critic Ken Tucker listened to Pop to figure out how it fits in with the more straightforward rock and roll the band usually plays.
Outside of America, they make more of a distinction than we do between the terms rock and pop. Rock is the hard stuff, while pop is still rock, but it's lighter, less concerned with the notions of sincerity and authenticity than rock is. So when U2, for more than a decade synonymous with a sincerity so elaborate it's been grandiose, decides to title its new album Pop and leads it off with a dance tune called Discotheque, they're signaling wildly to their constituency that something is up. What's up with U2 is that the band has decided to do two very risky things. First, the band hops on the techno bandwagon in order to goose its late 90s record sales. Then, feeling guilty, typically U2-ish, about selling out, they decide to act as if they're being ironic about the sellout and throw in some good music that points fingers at more fallible figures than themselves.
If Coke is a mystery, Michael Jackson history. If beauty is truth and surgery the fountain of youth, what am I to do? Have I got the gift to get me through the gates of that mansion?
I've never been able to get very attached to U2. I've always found them vainglorious whenever they're not just plain vain. But I like their last two albums, 1991's Achtung Baby and 1993's Zuropa, because they were full of raucous noise, burying the earnest lyrics and the bleat of their lead singer, Bono. By this standards, I like Pop just as much, if not more, because it offers a lot of noise. The band is still pumping up its material with gassy exhortations to God and Jesus, at one point writing a tune from the point of view of the Old Testament's David, who calls Christ on the carpet for giving mankind a hard time in a song called Wake Up Dead Man. I find this sort of irreligious religiosity really hard to bear. But I also have to admit that U2 can occasionally write a pretty song with this sort of stance, as in If God Will Send His Angels.
Nobody is here, baby. No one here to blame. No one to point the finger. It's just you and me and the rain. Nobody made you do it. No one put words in your mouth. Nobody here taking orders. When love took a train heading south, it's the black leading the blonde. It's the stuff. It's the stuff of country songs. If God will send His angels, and if God will send a sign, and if God will send His angels, will everything be?
Unlike R.E.M. and Pearl Jam, big-time rock acts whose recent recordings have bombed commercially, U2 is going to launch a big world tour this summer. It'll be interesting to see just how much pop music ends up in their act, or whether they'll continue preaching to the dwindling converted about how they still haven't found what they're looking for. Good luck, boys.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Alan Tu, and Amy Sallet, with Monique Nazareth and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.